emasculate. Aloha, mud babies, pod people, and inhabitants of the planet Earth. It is I, your tiki leader, Steve Mudflap McGrew. We got a great show today. We've got, hey, here's what the deal is. If you watch TV, if you watch Animal Planet, you know exactly who my guest is today. He's one of the big doctors from Emergency Vet. You ever watch Emergency Vet on Animal Planet? Then you know this dude. He takes care of all the exotic animals, the turtles, the snakes, the beetles, and it's Dr. Kevin Fitzgerald. He's going to be the guest here today. We've got a big show for you. It's a little bit longer because we got a lot to talk about. I hope you enjoy it. I want to remind you, you know, if you can find us on Stitcher and iTunes and Podbean and Spreaker Radio. And if you go to Podbean, our website, make sure you leave us some feedback there on the episode. And if you go to iTunes, please give us a review and help people find us because we need to make this thing grow. We're doing it. We're doing it. And we're doing it with you. All right? Here it is, Dr. Kevin Fitzgerald. All right. We are recording. It is rolling. We're sitting down here in the Remasculate Studios.
Basement.
That's the, I call it the studio because people come down and say, you got to come to the studio. And as you can see, it is set up much like a studio.
Well, it is. It is. You have some wonderful equipment. Yeah. No, thanks for having me, man.
Yeah, I appreciate it. We're sitting here with Kevin Fitzgerald. I don't know why I'm not hearing myself. There we go. A little bit better.
Yeah.
Kevin Fitzgerald, as you guys may know, Kevin is a TV star, and he was voted Bachelor. Did you get Bachelor at one point in People magazine?
Oh, I was one of the most eligible Bachelors. You know, but
seriously, how did that feel? I don't think I've ever asked you. How did it feel to be in People magazine as like the George Clooney of veterinary medicine?
Well, you have to take that stuff with a grain of salt. You know, when I worked for the Rolling Stones, Jagger, young bands would always come and ask him for advice, and he said, you want some advice? Take your clippings and your good reviews and put them up in your, throw those away or put those up in your bathroom because they don't mean anything. But read your bad reviews and read the stuff where you can better yourself, like what the critic didn't like. And maybe, you know, whatever you were doing, you can always get better. And so you see something like that, and you go, this is the weirdest thing. It was right at where we were doing the 2004. It was, they were doing the TV show still, and we've been doing it for a while, 7 or 8 years. And this woman called and said, hey, you know, this is so-and-so from People magazine. We want to have you on as one of the 25 most eligible bachelors. And it sounded like my sister-in-law, you know. So I said, Kathleen, that's not very nice. You do that to me. Come on, what are you doing? You know, how are the kids? This isn't Kathleen. This is really, you know, so-and-so, you know, Lily from People magazine, and so, I don't know. You have to take that stuff with a grain of salt. I think that, you know, you...
Did you get laid from it? That's what I wanted to...
No.
Women didn't start tracking you down, trying to find out where you live, do people like...
You know, I can really say that with that kind of stuff, I mean, whoever would be attracted to you because of something like that, mm-hmm. you know, that's not the kind of girl you want around anyway, probably. You know?
No?
No, you know, and so... I think for me with comedy, you know, maybe, you know, I'm older or whatever, then you know, I'm not like Elvis, you know, nobody's throwing room keys at me or, you know, or underwear.
Big giant panties.
Yeah, they would throw the ones that, you know, he didn't want to see, you know. He just goes,
big giant panties.
That's from Denver 10 awning, you know. That reminds me, I need a sail, you know.
Well, Kevin, let's start from the beginning. When did you start comedy? Or no, let's go even further back because I've known you for years and I know the whole story. I mean, I know that you were a bouncer for the Stones and you bounced with other bands like Wu-Tang and Poontang and those things. But were you bouncing to put yourself through veterinary school? What's the story?
Even before, you know, I grew up here. You know, I started off crying. You know, the doctor hit you on the tuition. You know, that's how I started off. You know, I started off crying, and still crying, still whipped out. So I grew up here in Denver, and you know, Irish, you know, and Catholic, and so in those years, those guys were, you know, my uncle and father and grandfather, you know, these guys were like these roosters, you know, these testosterone storms, and so everybody boxed, you know, everybody boxed. And my uncle Larry was coached, you know, and down at 20th Street, and so we all boxed down there. So in 68, the Golden Gloves, Faye saw me fight and said, you know, you can work the door for me. Chuck Morris and Chuck was, you know, worked the door at the Family Dog and at Tulagi for Chuck, you know, and Chuck went on and Ebbets Field and the Rainbow and you know, worked the door at these places. And I liked the music. I didn't know how to play an instrument.
But you like the music.
But like, you want to be around the music, yeah. You know, and what a great thing. And so, so 68, 69, and then at the end of 69, Barry revolutionized the rock and roll tour.
Barry Fay.
He went to the Rolling Stones and said, look, right now, every time you go on tour, there's a nut cutting every night in the accounting room about how many butts were in seats out there. And you have to deal with a different promoter in every city in the United States. For the whole tour, I'll do it. I'll sell every ticket, and you deal with me. And it had never been done. It was unheard of. And so, you know, Barry went and partnered with these different people in these different cities, and where there weren't guys.
Fayline Productions. That was the. I remember even growing up in Texas. Fayline. Oh, we did. I remember.
Yeah, we
doing
did shows.
Shows.
We did shows in Texas a lot, and so Houston, Dallas, Austin, and so. We did the Stones tour and then did the Stones in 69, 72, 75, 78, 81, 89, 94. And so I went out on the road with everybody Barry put out, and then I went to work also for Bill Graham. You know, so between 69 and 83, when I got out of vet school, whoever was on the road for the summer, you know, in those years, they didn't have, it was the Sunday. They don't have those big shows anymore,
right,
like they used to. They'd put these shows together that were like, you know, they would be so great. You know, it'd be a headliner and then an up-and-coming band and then a more medium band that, you know, probably couldn't do a big stadium. But they'd do these stadium shows, and they didn't know in those years what would happen. You know, you'd get 75,000 kids, you know, before Altamont, before Woodstock. Barry put on the Denver Pop Festival three nights here in May of 69. And I remember walking with him, and he goes, the venue, the field wouldn't let him. It was a Mile High Stadium. They wouldn't let him use the toilets because they were still doing baseball, and they didn't want the kids to trash the toilets and stuff, all the kids at the show, so we had to get sandlets. So we're walking around, and he goes, Kev, how many times do you think a kid pees in an hour? You know, I mean, it went from being this little thing at that time, 67, 68, where these bands are coming, and the bands would realize, and promoters would realize, that, wow, we can make money on this, to being, you know, the business,
right,
you know, this giant business that it is now. And the thing is, there aren't promoters now, like, you know, Chuck's still around with AEG, but you know, Barry and Bill Graham are gone, and there aren't big promoters like that. Now it's corporate sponsorship. Now, you know, it's Pepsi.
Budweiser,
you know,
presents, you know, Beyonce.
Yeah. So, you know, Chanel with the Rolling Stones and stuff. I mean, you know, it's giant corporate thing, and so it's a lot like comedy in that way. You know, you always said you were my comedy mentor, you know, starting off.
Shucks.
And you always said, listen, man, it's show business. There's the show, but there's the business end of it too. You have to be good at and realize, you know, how can you promote yourself? How can you, you know, you need a headshot, you need a tape to give people, you need, you know, you need to keep rolling the ball to keep it going,
right,
you know,
right.
And So it really came to me to see that with that business, from when I started to when I finished, you know, what the business had become, you know, with T-shirt sales and novelties and stuff, you know, for the big bands selling more in merch than they did in ticket sales that day.
Yeah, because everybody wants a T-shirt from the concert.
Sure,
they want something
in the beginning with the Stones, they didn't want to deal with plastic. They didn't want credit cards and have the headache, and they didn't want it. You know, it was one size. You know, it was a black long sleeve T-shirt, extra large for men, and a medium for women.
And that's it.
You know, and then it just got, oh, beer snuggies and visors, I want a commemorative program for the day with nice shots. And, you know, we can sell our DVDs of the thing, too, you know.
Yeah.
And a tour jacket, a right. silk tour jacket.
And that's when they became the merchandise manager. You had to have somebody, there's a whole truck and a guy that just drives this around.
So what happened was, oftentimes, you'd be on the road and the bootleggers would come. And they have bootleg T-shirts.
Yeah.
And so they aren't selling the, you know, they don't pay the tax with the city. They didn't do the venue charge and everything. And so they don't, you know, have a, they're not giving the band a cut. But sometimes their T-shirts would be nicer than the band ones.
You know? I've got a couple of those from Red Rocks, the guys out in the parking lot.
So what we'd see at Red Rocks and the different places in the United States, you know, we'd go a few blocks away and because we'd see the kids come up and they already got a T-shirt on for the day and go, that's not our shirt, but it's got the date. So they put the thing in Rolling Stone, and you see, oh, here's the tour, and here are the cities, and so they'd be ready. Sure. There the night before, drop all these boxes off. You see the kids come up. Now, legally, since they don't have the venue rights, they can't sell a T-shirt with your name on it, so you can put a gun to their head, you know?
And say, give me all my money?
And take the money and seize the product.
Uh-huh.
So with the Stones, it would happen every time, and it got they had guns, and so we couldn't just do the bouncers, so we'd get off-duty undercover cops, and they had guns, and then they'd seize the stuff, and they'd take the money, the band would take the money, but you'd have all this product, and they really couldn't sell it. So, you know, Jagger said, you know, orphanages, you know, let's give it to a children's home, you know, let's go down to the children's hospital. What about the burn place? You know, and they'd do that, you know. The thing about...
So you see all these third world kids in like Rolling Stone T-shirts.
Yeah, you see these kids, you know. But I don't know, man. You know the.
What's the wildest Rolling Stone story that you have?
Yeah. They're playing tonight in Sydney, and they called me today from a radio station in Sydney, Australia, and they said we want you to tell some stories about the drugs. They want to talk about the drugs, and so you know. I worked for him, you know. I was a worker bee. I realized right away that you know, you weren't part of the band. You know, this is a job, and I always got asked back, you know, because I did a good job, and I didn't do drugs, and you know, it was time to work. And so, I think the nicest Rolling Stone story for me is every show I did the advance. I go a day ahead of the band, and you know, Barry told me in the very beginning, he goes, I can't send a Jew to hire Irish cops. You know, they'll screw me, you know. And so I'd go a day at the head of the band. And I would, you know, go, hi, I'm Officer O'Shea. I'm Kevin Fitzgerald. We're in Houston. We want to do the Cotton Bowl. And you know, what, Sugar Bowl or Cotton? It was in Houston. I think it was a Cotton Bowl.
I can't remember. Anyway. I remember Hawthorne's Pavilion was
one of those. Yeah, so we'd be there. You know, I'm dating myself. This is in 1969, and he told me, I need 180 cops. And I knew I needed 30 for the gates and 30 for the parking lots. So I needed 60 cops, and he's going to have every off-duty cop in Houston working. So I said, oh, you know, Mr. Fay told me I could hire 20 cops. He goes, oh, God damn, you're breaking my balls. I don't care. Give me some more cops. 150, I need 150. I said, let me make a phone call. So I went and pretended like I was calling. And I came back and I said, he said I could hire 40. He goes, no, 100, 120. I need at least 120. I said, let me make a phone call. And I went back and he said I could hire 80. He goes, great, 80 cops. And he burned me for 20 more. But right. Barry heard I did that and said, you're my boy, you know. So you'd hire what we had to do was get them from the airport to the hotel, make sure the hotel was clean, and you know, get them then to the venue, look at the venue, hire the bouncers in that town, get out the Neanderthals and people that would kill people, you know. You want big, gentle guys. You don't want bloody mouths. You know, you want what I was proud of. I mean, you know, we put a lot of people in seats, and you know, we didn't have a trampling or anything. You know,
but I always hear the stories about the Rolling Stones using the Hell's Angels as bodyguards.
One time,
was that only a one time?
And that wasn't them. You know, that was the Grateful Dead at Altamont, and the Grateful Dead had used them always in San Francisco, and you know, so that wasn't that. You know, we came into that late, and that thing was already far along. You know, got there in the middle of the afternoon, and the other bands, the Jefferson Airplane and Flying Burrito Brothers, and you know, different bands that had been there and played, and it was a nightmare. And, you know, but so I do the advance, you know, and hire the people, and so during the show, my job was the front of the stage, and the lights go down, and, you know, the little bouncers from the town get scared, and you have to kind of be there with them and say, oh, no, here's how we do it. You're going to be cool, man. Just stick with me. And anything bad happens, be standing next to me, you know. And so I'm right with you. And so the lights go down, and the kids come from the sides down onto the floor.
Just rush it. Just
they rush down. So you can't have wheelchair kids down on the floor because they get knocked out of their chairs, you know. Mm-hmm. And they're, you're behind the barricade.
I'm not supposed to giggle.
And you can't get out and help them. You know, you can't get out and help them. So, you know, and then we'd go out and we'd get the floor back, you know, by coming from the back and pulling them off a few at a time and get the aisles clear again for the fire people. And what would happen would be they'd put all the wheelchair kids together in one place, you know. And you know what a thing, you know, a kid's in a wheelchair and now he's with only kids other than wheelchairs. I mean, he just wants to go to the show, you know.
Yeah.
You know, and so... So Jagger would always, you know, come at the beginning of the show and go, where are they? I go, 323. How many chairs? 23 chairs. And I'm dating myself, but I would get 23 cassette tapes and 23 T-shirts.
Uh-huh.
And we'd put a towel over his head or a hoodie. And he'd go out and we'd take him to the place. And he'd throw the thing off, you know. And he'd run down the seats. And he'd put a cassette tape and a T-shirt in everybody's seat. He wouldn't stay and talk to him. But, you know, hey, baby, thanks for coming to the show, you know. You know, and he didn't do it as a photo op. He didn't do it, and he didn't tell the press he was going to do it. Like, oh, look at the nice thing I'm doing, you know.
That was just his.
It was just him, you know. It was just him. And every time we'd be walking back and go, how come, Kevin? How come? How come, you know, we aren't disabled? Did you ever think of that? How lucky we are. He goes, you got this big body and get to come with us and, you know, and thump heads for us and we pay. And I got this, you know, this little voice and sing. And you know, he goes, we never can forget how lucky we are. And so I never forgot that, you know. I mean, you know, to me, people tell me stories about the Rolling Stones and stuff, and I go, well, you don't really know, baby, you know.
Well, that's what I was just fixing to say. That sounds like nothing that I would picture
Mick
to be, you know. I mean,
yeah.
Because we always say the Rolling Stones, they were the bad boys. They were the Beatles on acid, you know. That because that's what I remember when the Beatles and Stones came out, they were like, oh, the Beatles are so, you know, nice, and the Stones, like, they look dirty. Yeah, they look. I remember people saying they just look dirty.
I remember when I was a kid listening, you know, and you know, junior high and high school, and the Beatles came out with matching jackets, and they're so cute. Now, I knew that I didn't look like Paul, you know. I didn't know anybody that looked like Paul. And then you see the Stones, and, you know, they had, their hair wouldn't be right, you know, and you couldn't get your hair to be right, you know, and you had zits and they had zits.
They definitely had zits.
And they looked like guys you knew, you know. I talked to Keith one time, and he said, you know, they got us these matching jackets, and I got chocolate on my sleeve or something, so I couldn't wear mine, or I lost it, or I didn't know. So I wore something else, you know, and I mean, it just didn't fit. And some of it was imaging and stuff at the time, but the real thing with them was, you know, they're people, you know, they're just people. And so, you know, they have heels of clay and stuff, but they're legitimately good guys. You know,
Has Keith lived this long with the partying that he's done? What do you think, is that all an image, or was he really a partier? Or has he cleaned up a while back and he's just acting like he's still a bad boy?
Well, I mean, I think you look at somebody like Ozzy Osbourne and you go, ooh.
And then he sings perfect.
Yeah.
Crazy train!
You know, and you know, some of that's image and act probably, but you know, I always thought that a little of it was like Dean Martin type of things, you know. Like Dean Martin always had a drink, but was he really drunk? I mean,
right.
Who knows, you know, probably not. So some of it was well-earned, you know, probably, but some of it was image, you know. And
the new blood, is that for real?
No.
The whole,
no.
Keith,
no.
You know, Keith got new blood. You always heard about Keith went and got new blood. What?
Snorting his father's ashes.
Yeah. And,
you know,
that wasn't real either?
No. And so... You know, I mean, he's a family guy. You know, got the nicest wife in the world, you know, Patty Hansen.
For years. They've been married for years.
Yeah, you know, and beautiful, you know, and did the security, you know, for their wedding in Cabo San Lucas. And You know, and kids, you know, beautiful children, and you know, and a father, you know, and things that, you know, I remember one time, one of Jagger's daughters was at one of the shows in the beginning, and she was a college girl, she was in college at the time, and she was with a college roommate, and I hadn't seen her since she was little, since one of the tours the years before, and so it's like, you know, I want a beer. And I said, your father let you have beer? She goes, not at home. Here's the street fighting man, doesn't let his daughter drink beer in the house. You know what I mean? He's a father, you know what I mean? So I said, well, listen, you can have one and split it with your roommate, but if he finds out I didn't do it and I don't know anything about it, you know. I mean, but it just hits you funny, you know, that, and they're just people, you know. I mean, I think for them, you know, people talk about, oh, you have to reinvent yourself and you need a new image, or, you know, that Madonna does this, or whoever does, you know, has to bring up their image. And, you know, what's happened with them is, I think every 5 or 10 years, you know, people kind of rediscover and go, oh, that guy.
Oh, the Stones.
You know, they're still, yeah, that guy, look at those records.
Well, look at the Stones marketing in itself, though. It's always been the Stones. The lips and the tongue are, that is the Stones. There's never been any other thing like that.
No, I mean, you know, that was, you know, I think that was about the time Andy Warhol and you know, branding and things like that. And so it was very clever, you know. I mean, they're smart people. Nothing happens by chance. You know this from comedy. If you see somebody that's good and they say overnight sensation, chances are he's been doing it for 15 years and has done his comedy sit-ups and, you know, and you know, I think that the biggest thing I learned from them was, you know, be prepared.
Yeah.
You know, like they're like the Boy Scouts. I mean, you know, rehearsals, you know, months rehearsal before the road, rehearsal every day, sound check. I mean, so it's not, you know, I mean, the people are paying for the show. You know, it's show business. They want to see a show.
Well, you've worked now, you worked with the greatest in the rock and roll world, and you worked with, to me, one of the greatest in the comedy world. You were working with Joan Rivers, who, as we know, just recently died. But you did a bunch of stuff with her. What's your Joan Rivers story?
Well, she was killer funny. She was killer funny, you know, so funny. And there was a guy from her high school that was kind of hanging around, you know, on the tour, and she'd felt comfortable with people she'd grown up with. And the guy was in his 80s, you know, 80, 81, and she was old.
Well, she would feel comfortable and non-threatened by that.
Yeah. Well, no, but you know, you feel comfortable with the people you know.
Right.
Yeah. So he was kind of traveling, and he went in the bathroom, and he sat on the toilet, and he left the door open, and she said, hey, for God's sake, close the door. She goes, you're so old. When you sit on the toilet, your balls are so long, it looks like you're making tea. And then she went out on stage and did
it. Was this here at the Comedy Works?
No, we were in Phoenix. And I mean, to me, she was a comic's comic.
Yeah.
Because she had new jokes every time. And you remember when she started, man, it was a boys' club. There was Phyllis Diller and Toadie Fields and her. You know, so, you know, I think that, you know, she was groundbreaking because, you know, I mean, to me, she told jokes, you know, and it wasn't geared toward the women or geared toward the men. It wasn't this thing like, you know, you won't get this, you're a man, or you won't get this, you're a woman.
It's a woman thing.
You mean, a man and a woman are sitting next to each other, and they're both laughing their ass off.
Yeah.
And she was smart, you know, she was smart. She did the coolest thing I ever saw. She put new jokes down on idiot cards flat on the floor on the stage so she could see them and nobody else. And just one word that would, you know, spark her to remember that. Oh, I got this polar bear joke. I want to go, you know, and write the thing out, you know, and put it down flat. And nice.
That is so hard. That's one of the things even now for me to work new stuff in, because you're like, oh, I forgot. Oh, I didn't transition and I didn't do that. Just being able to remember.
Yeah, where do you put it?
Where do you put the new stuff? That's brilliant, of just having a piece of paper on the floor to kind of just trigger your brain to go, oh, I need to say that.
Yeah, and so, she, you know, and so nobody could see it but her. And she was, you know, when I worked for the Stones, Keith was always so nice to the fans, you know. They'd come up and go, you know, they pay our freight. We got to be nice. And he would always ask them a question. like, you know, like, oh, Keith, you know, hey, what do you do? You know, and I'm an electrician in Cedar Rapids, Iowa, you know. And
so he would turn it around.
And he'd talk about himself the whole time. The guy would talk about being an electrician. And Keith would just sit there and smile. And then the guy would leave and go, that's the nicest guy in the world. And all he'd done was talk about himself. And Keith goes, people like to talk about themselves, you know. And he goes, and if I have to listen for a second, you know, and he goes, that's okay. You know, and
that is so not the Keith that I think is getting new blood and snorting his father.
Oh, no, man. No, that guy, you know, in the end of the 78 tour, you know, he pays himself and, you know, he goes, hey, you've been with us 69, 72, 75, 78, my boss, Jimmy Callahan, you're going to get paid. And he goes, what are you going to do? He goes, you can't be a bouncer when you're 50. You know, why don't you go to school? I'll help you. I'll do something, you know. So I flew back to Denver, and my brother was working for U2, and I go, Keith told me I got to get a grip on my life. And he goes, man, what Keith Richards tells you, you got to. But he's the coolest cat in the world, you know, and he's the hippest guy ever. And so when he says something, you listen. You
know? So did you already know you were going to go to vet school then? No, or were you thinking about that? I was thinking,
you know, and it was so much fun, you know, I mean, going away with bands, you know, being to go on the road with the Rolling Stones as a little boy from Denver, that was like running away with the circus, you know.
Right,
it was the best, you know, and so you're living in I remember Bobby Keys, the sax player, you know, he just couldn't believe how lucky we were, you know. He's this saxophone player from Texas and great, and he just goes, man, you know, traveling with the Rolling Stones, man, we're shitting in high cotton.
Good, yeah. Shitting in high cotton.
So that was probably pretty much right. But so then I went to vet school, you know, and still did some tours in vet school, and, you know, some stuff on the side, you know, did the Jackson's Victory Tour in 85 and did the Wu-Tang in 2002.
Was that your last big concert?
Yeah. You know, they said they needed a crew of people that knew, kind of knew stuff. But they were, you know, I didn't know anything about rap, but man, I mean, you know, RZA, the stuff he's done, soundtracks and, you know, I mean, really talented people, you know, and it's generational, you know. I remember my father walking around the house on Saturday mornings, help my mother dust, and he'd turn on Frank Sinatra. He's got his boxer shorts on, and he's snapping his fingers, and he's going, man, this swings. And you think my brother's making the square sign, you know, behind
so
him.
But
now I listen back, you know, and that Nelson Riddle stuff and some of that Frank Sinatra stuff, and it does swing.
It does.
And so...
And it doesn't mean a thing if it ain't got that swing.
That's right. And so I think, you know, music, you know, it touches us. I remember when I was working for Willie Nelson, and Willie would look out before the show at the crowd and kind of gauge the crowd and get a sense of who was there. And he goes, you know, Kevin, he goes, 99% of those people aren't with their first choice person they want to be with. And he goes, and that's why they'll always listen to my songs on the jukebox.
Wow! Those aren't their first choices.
Yeah, you know, and that's why they'll always listen to my songs on the jukebox.
Because you got to have heartbreak songs. You know, huh?
But man, Willie was... I mean,
and still is.
You talk about running away with the circus. You know, Pootie was my cousin, his bouncer, and so he hired us, and you could take, you met a girl, you could take her on the bus with you. You know, and you should go 14, 15 cities and then send her back to her parents. You know,
more or less
in one piece. You know, you would hope, but you know, who's this with you? this is Linda. I like you, Linda. Thanks for coming.
Want to stay on the bus?
but Willie was so funny. I mean, he had the best jokes, and still, you know, just
was he Weed Willie then? Was he still at that point already into weed?
Well, you have to understand, when you're working with these people, there's a danger. And if you get too close, then you know, you got to remember your place. And so, you know, I didn't eat with them or do drugs with them. I didn't drink with them. You know, I'm there to do a job. You know, I'm there to, you know, make sure everybody, you know, gets in and out safe and everybody's right and the crowd's okay and it's a nice show. So, but you know, I think he was different. You know, he approached weed Like, I didn't see him ever drink. And he approached weed a lot like when I bounced for Tosh, you know, for Peter Tosh, the reggae. And I did the reggae Sunsplash for a number of years in Kingston and the World Jamaican Music Festival in 82 for Barry.
So you had a contact high.
So, well, but those guys, you know, it's like a sacrament, you know, like an herb, you know. Yeah. You know, it's made from the earth,
it's,
you know.
It's the ganja.
Yeah, and Willie was like that, you know. Willie was like that. But, man, that guy, he's so funny, you know. You know, he goes, "You play golf, Kevin?" "No, I don't." You know, he goes, "I do." He goes, "Best two balls I ever hit when I stepped on a rake." You know, I mean, just stuff like that all the time, you know. And just, you know, maybe Kinky Friedman would be on the tour, you know.
Yeah, I met Kinky long ago.
He's playing tonight.
Is he?
In Denver, yeah. And
where is he?
I think he's at the Jewish Community Center, the theater there, you know.
I met him down in Texas just recently because he was thinking about running for governor again. So that we're having this.
But he makes sense. He makes sense, some of the stuff he says, man. You know, the stuff he says about a flat tax and, you know, some of the stuff.
Yeah.
But man, he had this band, and they came to Tulagi's, and they needed somebody to go with him, and so Chuck let me go, and man, he was so funny, and Kinky Friedman and the band, the Texas Jew Boys.
Get your biscuits in the oven and your buns in the bin.
Yeah, and, you know, they don't make Jews like Jesus no more.
Yeah.
You know? But he would come out and he'd do the fun. This is the funniest thing I ever saw, okay? They'd play a few songs, you know, and you know, they'd start playing, and after three or four songs, you go, "Well, ladies and gentlemen, right now I'd like to introduce the band." And he'd walk over to the guitar player and go, "Hello, I'm Kinky Friedman," and shake hands. And then the band would all walk around and shake hands like they didn't know each other.
Themselves?
Yeah, like they didn't know each other. And, "Hello, I'm Kinky Friedman." And it just, you know, and every night, you know, it's just that, "Well, folks, this has been my financial pleasure to work for you tonight. It's been a financial pleasure to come here." And so, you know, it just so funny. I mean, he was, you know, the stuff he would do, he just, you know, driving by the Grand Canyon and look at it and say, "Imagine what God could have done if he had a little money."
Just random.
Yeah, you know, it's the Grand Canyon.
It's nice.
It's beautiful.
Imagine what he could have done if he had a little money.
Imagine what he could have done if he had a little money. So I always liked comedy, you know, and you saw that. And so the second funny thing I ever saw, you know, with an act like that, the first was Kinky introducing the band. I mean, I'd see that 50 times in a row and fall down every time, you know. "Hello, I'm Kinky Friedman," to the guitar player, you know. And so the second friend was, I was working for Linda Ronstadt, and she was going with Albert Brooks at the time. And he was the opening act, and so he's very funny, very funny.
Yeah.
And
always thought so.
Yeah, so, and his brother, you know, Super Dave.
Super Dave Osborne.
Man, oh man, those guys. And their dad, you know, Harry Einstein, the announcer for Jack Benny.
Oh, I did not know that. I did not know.
You know, betting him they would name a kid Albert Einstein. You know? I mean, you know. So, you know, I mean, well, anyway, it would be Linda Ronstadt. And you know, they'd go, "All right, tonight." And it would be a tape. In those days, it was tapes. They'd be playing this tape, and it was Albert Brooks' voice. "Tonight, ladies and gentlemen, Linda Ronstadt, let's hear for Linda Ronstadt." And the people go crazy, and you go, "Okay, and, you know, Linda Ronstadt's going to be out here, Linda Ronstadt," you know. And then he'd be dressed as a blind guy, and he had a big, long jacket on and a white cane and glasses, and he'd be standing where there were no empty seats at all just full of seats. "Okay, folks, you know, we can't get started until everybody's in their seat. You know, the fire laws are very hard in this city. You know, we can't get started. So soon, Linda Ronstadt said, but first we got to get in your seats." And he's the only guy standing.
So the tape
up.
Is saying this, but yeah. He's pretending to be the black guy.
So the crowd is getting a little nervous, you know. And so he's like, "Folks, we really can't get started until everybody finds a seat." And then he's "Will somebody find that blind son of a bitch a seat?" And everybody would jump up, you know. And then he would knock him away with the cane, and then he'd jump up on the stage and start playing piano how he started. And man, it was, for me, that was very clever. His stuff was very clever.
That was those guys of Albert Brooks and Steve Martin and all those guys who were in that same little group of of comedy, and they were brilliant before their time. Robert Klein's and those guys.
Steve Martin, when I worked for the Nitty Gritty Dirt Band, he was the opening act. And you could tell something was going to happen with him. I mean, he was...
His manager, isn't his manager the brother of...
Right, the McEwen.
McEwen, yeah.
McEwen's brother. But he was doing so much funny stuff. You know, I'd like to now play the national anthem on the banjo. Put the banjo flat on the ground, put a tape deck on it, and play the national anthem and leave the stage. You know? And so...
But we thought that was... It still is funny. But we thought it was hysterical at the time.
Absolutely
hysterical.
I still think that stuff, you know.
But I listened to Steve Martin's album not long ago, Let's Get Small.
Does it seem dated?
It seems dated. But I remember just laying on the floor, listening and just laughing my ass off and just... And now I think it's funny, but I'm like, why did we go absolutely nuts for this? Was because it was slightly different than what we had heard in the past.
Well, it was different. I think that there's things that that are like time sensitive, that are specific to a specific time, and the cultural landscape was just enough right, and it had come along enough. Comedy changes, you know, it changes.
Yeah.
I remember playing, you know, when we were in college. We discovered Henny Youngman and these old Jewish guys, and so we'd drive from Boulder, where I went to school, to see Henny Youngman in Las Vegas, and so I bought a Henny Youngman record, you know, and so I took it home and played.
Take my wife, please.
And take it to my father, and he goes, "What do you like this stuff? I remember this in the '40s. This is old stuff. What are you laughing at this for?" I'd never heard it, you know. So I think that, you know, I think as things change and comedy changes and so, but I think there'll always be a place for, you know, physical comedy. I mean, like we talked about before, comedy's oranges and apples. You can have a physical comic, you have a guy that's just a talking head that just says funny stuff, you know, a guy that's in left field, a guy that, you know, I don't know, you know, I've tried different things. I started off, you know, with the Frogs of Power and the different things I tried, you know, juggling frogs, and it never worked.
Well, you're kind of known around town as the Love Show, Dr. Kevin's Love Show.
Well, I thought that was a place for a variety act, you know, a variety show.
Still think so, too. And I don't know if you heard this or not, Neil Patrick Harris, you know, the kid that was Doogie Howser,
sure.
He's just signed to do a variety show on TV. They're going to try to bring the variety show back. I've always thought the variety show was one of the greatest things ever.
With the Love Show, my brother and I did that, and you know, we'd have 10 acts, and they each got, you know, 6 minutes, and then we would come out between and tell jokes and tap dance, and he'd play guitar, and we'd, you know, do different things, and so you know, we had a guy with the pigs that rode skateboards.
I saw them.
You know, he's been on America's Got Talent.
Yeah.
We had Sadie, the lovely Sadie that, you know, was on America's Got Talent, the belly dancer.
You had the lesbian, know, Elvis.
The Shelvis. She Elvis. And we had a knife thrower that we found up in Central City, put his wife on a wheel and spin the wheel.
Well, here's my favorite. I want you to tell this one, because this is one of my favorite. And I never got to see this, but you told me about it, and I just thought it was the funniest thing ever. The dude that would let you throw shit at him.
Oh, the human target. We found him on the mall in Boulder, and he had a hockey mask on and a big target on his chest. And he had this big box full of pots and pans and, and frying pans and skillets and stuff, you know. You know, you go, "Ladies and gentlemen, that human target." And when we found him, you know, we're talking to him, I said, "How long you been doing this?" He goes, "Well, I've been in show business about 3 years."
Show business.
The people are throwing stuff at him, you know.
Show business.
And so they throw these things. And you know, at first when people are throwing stuff, they didn't even understand. And the crowd is like, they don't want to do it. I mean, I have to throw something at him. Like if you tell somebody to punch somebody in the head.
Harder.
No, I'm not going to hit you hard. So they start off throwing slow, but now they kind of get cocky.
Uh-huh.
By the end of boxing, they're throwing. They're winging these skillets at this guy, you know. And he's got this hockey mask, and he's flinching a little and moving. And finally get hit in the chest with a skillet and knock him off the bar stool, and he would be on his back, and he'd have the wind knocked out of him, and his wife would come out and go, "Stop it, stop it. You see, he's had enough," and give him smelling salts, you know.
"Can't you see he's had enough?"
And so, you know, I told him, I said, how much do you want for this? How much do you want us to pay? He goes, I think $75 would be plenty.
Yeah. Show business is hard.
And so we couldn't do it at the Comedy Works anymore because the stuff would bounce and break the lights and, you know, and bounce into the people. And so same with the knife thrower, you know, but there were great things, you know, like.
Well, I remember you telling me, too, one night, he goes, I can't do this much longer. Show business is.
Show business is a tough game, you know. You're getting hit with a skillet in the chest.
I can't do this much longer.
And so we had a couple of ladder comics, ladder acts, you know. Uh-huh. And I didn't even know about those. And there was this old Jewish guy, and he goes, I go, what do you do? He called me up and said, I want to do your show. And I said, well, what are you? And he goes, well, I'm a ladder act. Because there aren't many of us anymore.
What is a ladder act?
And he goes, I tell a joke, and then I climb up this ladder, this step ladder, this short step ladder, and then I jump off and land on my chest on this sponge.
On a sponge?
Yeah. So okay. I go, flat on your chest? He goes, yeah. And then I tell another joke, and I get up, I tell another joke, and I jump off, and you know, and then finally I get to the top rung and jump off, and then it just totally knocks the wind out of me. I can't tell any more jokes.
So you hit him on the show.
Hit him on the show, and then we had a contortionist, and we had you know, the guy had he was a 6-year-old master, some kind of genius kid. That could play the violin, you know, and then we had, a real variety show. You know, we had a cat that could pick cards, you know, pick the card, that uh-huh. you know, and it never worked. You know, and go, oh, he's somehow confused by the lights, you know.
You know, but at least put a paw out,
yeah,
or something.
Put a paw on the card. No, it's not your card. So, I don't know. So
was your brother in this thing too?
Yeah,
Was he part of the Well Hungarians?
Yeah, he was a guitar player. He played with some bands around town, and a good guitar player. And so, you know, I wanted something we could do together. You know, and
Biscuit.
And be, yeah, no, this is John.
Oh, okay.
Another one. And this is John. And so he did it with me, and then he went into the sunset with it. But yeah, he was funny, you know. And then our mother wanted to do it.
Mom did?
Yeah, she goes, I got an act I could do, you know.
You'll be like the Partridge Family.
I go, what can you do? And she goes, I met this black man that he plays a conga, and I sing Lady of Spain on the accordion. And so she can play the accordion a little bit. And you're like, Lady of Spain, I adore you. This guy with his chest off, this giant guy, you know, in harem pants, you know, like, you know, you know, like genie pants and hitting this
hammer
thing.
Hammer pants to younger
people. Oh, man. And so the crowd is, you know, the good thing about a variety show like that was after 6 minutes, you're through the act. And if you don't like it, it's like you clap your hands and like, I tire of this. Bring me the pigs that ride skateboards. And then I find this mildly amusing. What about the belly dancer? So you constantly keep going. And at the end of the night, they go, what the hell did we just see? You know, we had the Bondos, the jugglers. You know, they'd always do it. And you know, the knife thrower.
The last one that I saw, for me, was you did it at the Oriental Theater. And you had singers and a guy that shoved himself in a plastic box. You had Michael Floorwax came out and sang a song.
So you don't know, you didn't know what was going to happen. You know, you didn't know Wax had a voice.
I didn't know that he sang that well.
No, and it's pretty.
And he was super nervous. Wax was super nervous.
He left for a while because I can't do it. Not going to do it.
Is that what did he? Because I was trying. We were talking in the back. He goes, I got to focus. I got a song. I got to do. I got to focus.
You know, when I started, I got close to you and I got close to Wax early on. And you know, what I found out, you know, Wax is the one who said, you know, he goes, you know, you have to be careful. You know, we're like vampires. We can see each other in the dark as comics. You know. But you have to keep your other friends, your civilian friends, up, because after a while, you'll only like to be around the other vampires.
Yeah.
You know? And he goes, and there's something wrong with us. I go, there's something wrong with us? He goes, yeah. Most people's biggest fear is public speaking. And we want to get out there. You know, you watch the guy who's gone next, and he's mad that the guy's going too long, and he's, you know, he's kicking the stalks. He wants to get out there. He goes, most people will be dying. He goes, we want to get out there. He goes, and there's something wrong with us. You know, we want approval, or we want, you know.
That makes a lot of sense, because I'm totally the opposite. I'm afraid of real life people. I don't mind getting on stage and just making stuff up and playing, and I actually pretend like I'm in my own little world. Like, some people even ask me, do you make eye contact? No, I fake looking at people, but I kind of just live in, like, if I was in my room trying to create a one-man show. So, but then you get out in the real world, and people, you know, you get at parties and stuff, and I'm like, oh, you're really quiet. Yeah, I don't really like to talk to people. Because if you say something, then they're going to go, well, you're not funny. You know? Yeah, I'm not funny all the time. So you like hanging out with people that understand you.
Yeah,
like you said, the other vampires.
The other vampires. You don't have to talk, maybe.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
You know, I don't get to see you that often. And when I do, you know, you're like, oh, man, it's McGrew, you know? And so you're psyched. You know? I remember asking you, you know, how do you hold the microphone here? Can you do it like that? Or
you got to hold the microphone a little closer to your face. You got to talk it. They have to be able to hear. You got to be able to hear you.
He said the jokes are funnier if they can hear you. Yeah. And you know, you worry about, you know, stage clothes and stuff, or what you should wear on stage. And I remember, you know, Keith telling young bands, you know, you should. It's a show, and you should look nicer than the crowd. They're paying to come see something, and you know. He said, so, get
something flashy.
Yeah, into these young bands. I always thought about that, you know, because you see some of these guys, you know, and they look like they're going to, you know, work on the weeds in the yard, you know.
But I think things have changed a little bit in comedy, because you used to want to be really show businessy, like Liberace, you know, like just high and flashy. And, you know, the guys wore suits and stuff. And I think now the crowds almost feel like if you dress too nice, you're talking down to them. There's almost, I feel like there's...
Well, nobody dresses up anymore.
Yeah, the audience.
You go to restaurants, you know, particularly in the western part of the United States, you know, it's so laid back, you know, and you go into a nice restaurant, and you know, a guy's got a T-shirt on and stuff, and... You know, it's a Saturday night, and he's out on a date with, you know, and you just go, wow, you know.
You got a wife beater on.
Yeah. Well, maybe not that bad, but maybe, you know. I mean, you see these people, and you just go, this guy doesn't have a mirror in his house.
Exactly, yeah. You know? Well, you see that in Vegas a lot. I mean, when Vegas went from the tux and the Frank Sinatra, Dean Martin, looking good, going out, the women are in gowns, it's Vegas, baby, to, like, you have on shorts, flip-flops, and you're sitting in a showroom.
Yeah, I think we could still dress a little nicer. I think, you know, you got to look sharp. You got to be comfortable. You know, I find that I have lucky shirts.
Do you?
For comedy. In other words, where you go, I've never had a good set in that shirt, you know. And it's your own mind, you know, playing
right,
with you.
Right, right. I used to feel that way about shoes. Well, years ago, I felt like I had to wear these red shoes, or... I had a skinny tie at the time that I thought this was.
I remember how you used to dress. I remember your hair.
Yeah, the big old tall Elvis hair.
And you, we measured it one time in the dressing room, and your hair was taller than your face, from your chin to your forehead. It was you know, so you had more hair piled up. You know, so it was like a whole nother head or a whole nother face.
But people used to say that was one of the funniest. Like when you talk, your hair would shake. It was hysterical. You know, so there were certain things you played off of at the time. Like somebody told me the other day, like John Crist, you know, local guy John Crist, very funny new guy here in town, getting a lot of stuff. But somebody goes, you know, John's got your old hair. I go, what? He goes, yeah, it's all spiky and sticking up, and you know, like, yeah, well, you know, things come around. You know,
everything goes full cycle.
Yeah,
he'd never seen. I watched the new guys, you know, and. You know, I think one of the sad things for me with comedians is sometimes you would see somebody that you really admired and it was a great comic, and they were kind of sad because there would be people that were coming along after them that in, you know, their own mind, that person had gone farther, you know, than they had.
Yeah.
You know, and I don't know, one of the nice things that happened to me is some of those Boston comics like Don Gavin. Gavin told me, he goes, I'm not going to get discovered and get a TV show. And he goes, it's okay. He goes, I'm making a good living. That's what I like to do. People ask me, he goes, what do you hope? Do you hope to get a sitcom? He goes, nah, I hope to keep telling jokes till I'm 80 years old.
Hope to pay my bills.
Yeah. He goes, you know, I'm okay with how far I've gotten. You know, he was okay with it and not envious. And so when I see stuff happen with the other Denver comics particularly, I'm happy for him. You know, legitimately happy because I think it brings all our stock up.
I do too. I think it brings attention to comedy or the town or whatever. Yeah. But I remember having the discussion with somebody about not hitting where I started. You know, when you start, you think, I want sitcoms, I want movies, I want to do that. And I was talking about how I had those deals, I had a big agent, got close, blah, blah, blah. And then somebody said to me, you're a working comic. You're paying your bills. That's better than a lot of them have ever done. You've made a total living your entire life writing and telling jokes. And yeah. I'm like, oh, I guess that's true. I did accomplish the goal, but I didn't make the giant goal, you know.
But who does, you know? At what price? And you know, the thing I think with comics that I've seen, for a little while, like the flavor of the month, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And then they're on to somebody else. Yeah. You know, it's always the new next thing. You
well,
know?
Somebody recently, a friend of mine, an actress, Jewel Shepherd, she was in the movie Return of the Living Dead, and she did a lot of those Hollywood hot tubs and, you know, Jailbait, a lot of those kind of drives.
The movies I like.
Yeah, you would recognize her, know her. And she said on Facebook not long ago to me, because we had the same agent, we were with APA, and she goes, I remember when you were Flavor of the Month in L.A. That's what sparked it, because she goes, I remember, because I was being drug around to all the meetings, and I got to do all the TV shows, and, you know, was meeting with ABC, and you kind of go, yeah, I remember that too, and that's what makes you go, I was that close.
Yeah, but, you know? I how much better, I think, you know, than worrying about that stuff, than to just consistently give a good product and have a good body of work over a period of time where people can go, oh, that guy was always good. You know, the promoters or bookers could say, you know, we can always bring him in and you know, the people that have, you know, I mean, we were talking about being edgy before or you know, when you see a comic, it makes people walk and goes, oh, you know, I'm proud of it. You
right.
Know? Wait, they came to see you. You're punishing the people that paid to see you, you know?
Well, there's always, though, the guys in comedy, like, and I won't say they're not funny, because they are, but people like Doug Stanhope or we were talking about Ben Roy, who I love, Ben, they get a crowd either love, hate, and their fans are rabid fans. If you're so far out and edgy, you either get people that just love you and they'll worship you, or if you stay too middle of the road, they're like, yeah, he's good. Yeah, he's funny. So do you have to go so far out that you just have to people make, yeah, my friends hate him, but I love him. You know what I'm saying?
You know, there's no disputing taste. You know, some people like vanilla and some people like butterscotch, you know. So I think there's something for everybody, you know. I think if you look at Denver Comics, you know, that I know, I mean, that's what I know the best. You know, there's people that are more middle of the road. There's people, you know, I always had kind of a worry that doing comedy, but then also being a veterinarian today, that if I got too far out there, it was too dirty, then people go, oh, that's a dirty comic. You know, that guy, you know, he did these gross jokes, and don't take your dog to him. I worried about that.
Did you fear that, really?
Yeah, a little bit. And so, you know, you kind of, but then I also learned that, you know, it's harder. When I started, I was filthy. You know, my jokes were all like, you know, used to wrestle when I was in college, and I, you know, most of the people wrestled till they pinned somebody, and I just wrestled till I came. You know, and you know, you're not going to hear that on Animal Planet. You know,
no, you would not hear that.
And so I realized that for me, it was harder to write a clean joke. But you could do it more. You could do it any place, and you didn't limit yourself, you know.
Yeah.
And you know, you see some of my favorite comics, you know, Bobby Slayton, you know, the Pitbull, and Robert Schimmel, and some of the guys. That,
right, me too.
But they realize that
you can't work everywhere.
They're not for everybody, you know, and they're not going to do the Baptist summer convention.
Right.
You know?
Right. Right.
You know, so. So I think, you know, but it's like apples and oranges, you know. I think all you can worry about is your act and not compare it to other acts. You know, I mean, for a while I didn't listen to any comedy because I was afraid
it influenced you somehow,
yes,
some way.
And,
yeah.
And that, you know, I would find is I would go out and I'd be doing my jokes in somebody else's voice, not stealing their jokes, but all of a sudden I'd have somebody's cadence or you know.
Which reminds me, I was going to ask you this, it dawned on me earlier, and that just reminded me. Now, remember when Denver first got the two clubs, the Comedy Works and George McKelvey's club? Do you remember how there was like a separate version of your act at the other club? Like,
well, there'd be a guy that would do almost your jokes.
You know, like Floor Wax had a version of Ricky. Remember that?
Pink Ricky. That guy was the nicest guy. His wife was a stripper, and she would make the costumes for all the other strippers, you know. And so, I mean, yeah, Pink Ricky.
But there was a whole thing. I remember people talking about it, how, like, if you were working at the Comedy Works, there was another version of you down at the other club. You know, there was...
there was Keith Fitzpatrick somewhere else. You know?
You know?
Sean McHugh.
Right.
Did you see Steve McGrew? No. Well, I mean, I don't know, man. You know, I think... You can't take yourself too seriously. I really believe, like I said, that all you can worry about is your stuff. And do, you know, we're all trying the best we can, you know, and who am I to judge other comics? You know, I mean, I think, you know, people say, oh, that guy's this or that guy's that, you know, but I mean.
But that's why you can't do competitions. That's why I've never really appreciated competitions.
Yeah, but the competitions are so stupid because they usually have a DJ that doesn't know anything about comedy but thinks he's funny as shit, you know, and a Bronco, and then somebody from the sponsor of the airline, the lady from the airline, who's, you know, a little Christian woman goes, oh my, she just do a breast flop joke. I just, chuck about me, side boob joke,
or the things that's popping up so everywhere of the festivals of comedy, and yet you know, like, well. You're playing a booth over in the Mexican restaurant at this one part of it, and you're doing this over. It's like, how can you judge comedy when it's not in a comedy club in a perfect setting? Like, you have to be heard, you know. I think they just get into these. They kind of just pat themselves on the back at the festival, but then they become good friends and they help each other along. So I can see that part of it too.
Well, that's right. You know, I think. A lot of it goes down to self-promotion, you know, and some people do it better than others. I've never been very good at it, you know. I'm you're kind of embarrassed to, you know, could you put me on your show? I mean, it's that's not me. And with this business, you have to punch yourself a little bit to get ahead.
Yeah, well, that's one of the things the girlfriend and I recently were talking about of. The bit of self-promotion that you have to do, like you have to say, hey, I'm working on this, or hey, I've been tapped to possibly write on this show, or I got an audition for, and she goes, but you post that and then you don't get it, then what do you go, yeah, but if you don't say you're doing something, you're completely out of sight of other people, you know, like, oh, did he just audition for that? Maybe I should have him come audition for me. See, you kind of have to create your own buzz every once in a while.
Yeah, there has to be an energy to it.
Yeah.
You know, and a good energy, a good vibe, where you just go, you know, I worked at Jimmy Carter's inaugural. You know, what? When was he president?
That was the last time you worked?
Yeah. You know, so, no, there has to be a buzz. There has to be a little bit of a buzz and something, you know, that they like. Or what do you got coming up next? Where are you going next? What are you doing? You know?
Right. So you got to have something ready to go, at least say, I'm working on this,
yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
Well, before I let you go here, because we're going on an hour, I've got to know. I want to know a biscuit story. It's one of the things that I've always loved. You and your brother have had some of the best adventures, and there's two of them that I can remember you telling me about. One of them was escaping handcuffs out of a car.
Yeah.
And the other one was starting a fight in a ski gondola.
Yeah. Well, Bisque was he was a force of nature, you know. He's been gone 8 years.
Has it been that long?
Yeah. And so he was something, man. He was something, and he was an acquired taste. I mean, he wasn't for everybody, you know. But
I remember him hanging out at the club. Was always a super nice guy.
Yeah, yeah. And so he's a big guy, you know. And so he played football at CU, and it was a great rugby player. And so we went up to Aspen, and we with this other kid we played rugby with, Doug Nouse. It's a huge guy, and tried out for the Olympic wrestling team, and you know. So we saw Arnold Schwarzenegger, you know, and Maria Shriver. And I was like, hey, look, it's Arnold. And then Arnold was our hero, you know, the Austrian Oak, and these guys were huge weightlifters, Biscuit and Nouse. So we kick our way in the ski line. They're in the tow line way at the front. There's three of them, some guy and Maria and Arnold. We kick our way up, and security for them. Excuse me, security, you know, get out of the way, please. You know, and the people, just pushing away, just
toughen your
way, way right through. So we get right on them. So we're going to get on the same gondola. So there's three facing one way at Aspen and three facing the other way. So they're all facing the other way, and we're facing. And Arnold's trying to scare Maria, and he's swinging the thing, you know. And he's rocking the thing. And Bisc is afraid of heights anyway. And so the thing's rocking, and he goes, if he doesn't stop doing that, I'm going to trash him, I'm going to screw him up, you know, I'm going to fuck him up, you know. And so.
But it's Arnold.
It's Arnold, you know. And Maria's getting nervous. Going, Arnold, those people are talking, you know, you're scaring those people, you know.
I rocked that gondola, you know.
And then Biscuit's, that's it. I'm going to fuck him up. All of a sudden, man, this big hand came over. Bam! It gets him right in the chest. And he goes, and then you woke up. you screwed me up in your dream. You know?
So we were Arnold like, grabbed your brother?
He hit him in the middle of the chest with his hand. And slapped him. And then you woke up. And we were like mice, you know. Our ears went back. And we were just sitting there like, you know. Like, all of a sudden we became like Stuart Little, you know. We're just like, yeah, so that, you know, that you shouldn't have made me tell that. There's three totally American things that you need to see. You need to see the Kentucky Derby, the Indianapolis 500, and the Mardi Gras. And so we're going to go to all three this year, you know, and we're going to see all three. And I mean, he just had these things, you know, in his mind that you know, what you think he would do, you know. But I mean, he was so much fun. You'd be doing those stuff like, you know, a grandmother died, and he got left $7,000, and he goes, hey, I figured out what we're gonna do with the money. And I said, what are we gonna do with the money? And he said, we're gonna become entrepreneurs. And I didn't even know what it meant. And I go, yeah.
What, well, you can Google to find out?
Yeah, what you couldn't Google stuff then. This is 1969, man. And so I said, yeah. He said, give me the money. Give me your $7,000. Like, what are we doing? He goes, well, just east of Boulder, we're going to buy a worm ranch. And I go, a worm ranch? He goes, yeah, they always need worms for fishing and stuff. It's a Circle O worm ranch. And I go, yeah. And he goes, we're going to live right there. There's a trailer right on the property. And there's a guy that comes with it. He's the wrangler, Juan, the Mexican wrangler, the worm wrangler.
Worm wrangler.
And so you put down these big tarps, and you put the water on the tarp, and then the worms come up because of the water. So then we had to get these styrofoam things and put the worms in and sphagnum moss, you know. And we lived in this horrible trailer. I called it the Tilton Hilton because it was, you know, on a slant, you know.
Tilton.
And so, you know, so my mother sees me, and she goes, well, what did you do with Grandma's money? And I said, I invested it, became an entrepreneur. She goes, well, God, that's good. What'd you do? I said, I bought a worm ranch. She goes, what? And I said, I bought a worm ranch, you know. And so she goes, you spent Grandma's money on an insect farm. And she tried to choke me. She just came across the table, you know. And so it didn't go very well, you know.
How long did the worm ranch last?
Well, 6 months. And then we had it. I wish I had the hats. We had these hats with a worm with a big smile and a cowboy hat, you know. And this Circle O, and the worm was in an O. He was making the O.
Like, okay.
You know.
Worms are okay.
You know. And so there was a drought, and there was a worm drought. Uh-huh. We couldn't find any. And, you know, Juan's like, no worms today again. You know, God damn it, Juan, we just got to sell some of these.
So what did y'all do? Just end up selling the worm ranch?
Yeah, no, it got all bulldozed over in its condos. If we would have had that property, man.
Think of that.
But, you know, I mean, he could talk into that stuff, you know. I mean, one time we made these styrofoam heads for Halloween. I was thinking about that. And he was Bullwinkle,
uh-huh.
You know, and he had this Bullwinkle head on made out of styrofoam with styrofoam antlers, you know, white antlers that went out that he cut. And I was a shark, and he was driving his Jeep, and we were driving home. And he had to drink through the eye hole. He had the thing on. He'd pull the bottle and jam it into the eye hole, you know, and put his mouth up to it. And a cop pulled him over and said, sir, please remove your headdress.
Your headdress.
I mean, they put you in jail for that stuff now. You know, but 40 years ago, we didn't know. And, it's not funny to talk about, you know, drinking and driving, or it's not funny to talk about, you know, or to glorify that, or you know, seeing girls' wool, or the
seeing the wool,
the horrible Von Dahm story. I mean, you know,
those are the past. That's the past. But things have become so politically correct, and so, you know, you can't do this, and you'll go to jail for that. I mean, I can understand it, but it just doesn't seem like there was a lot more fun in the past.
Well, I think as you get older, there's a tendency to that, but that, you know, it's a new day, and there's new kinds of fun, you know?
Netflix.
Well, no.
Sit at home, watch TV.
No, I think I've been trying some stuff with these puppets, you know? And I got this one, you know, that it looks like me, the puppet looks like me, you know, and you bring him out on stage. Or I got another puppet that's a mime. You know, so he's got a mime face, but you're a ventriloquist, you know, and your puppet's a mime. He's now going to be in a box. He'll climb a rope.
So you're a ventriloquist that doesn't talk.
Yeah. You know, it's a,
see his lips move.
Audience doesn't get it. But a lot of my stuff they've never gotten, so that's all right.
Yeah. We got it today, though. I appreciate you coming and doing the podcast,
I didn't even know what a podcast was, you know. You know, the pod, you know. That's the invasion of the body snatchers. You know,
that's true. You'll be all slimy when you leave here. There'll be a separate Kevin.
I've always heard that you've done this, and I was honored to be here. And, you know, man, I think if your listeners, you know, if they listen, they must know you and know what a powerful act you are.
Oh, well, appreciate that. You too. We need to do more shows together.
Well, can we tell the one story?
Yeah, go ahead.
The story when I was trying to, I was emceeing for it, and I was trying to talk to the girl.
Uh-huh.
Can you tell that?
You can't.
She was your hairdresser, one of them.
She was my hairdresser.
Yeah, yeah. One of them was his hairdresser, and she came.
And my neighbor. She was my neighbor.
His neighbor and hairdresser came to the show, and I was emceeing, and it was a two-man show.
Yeah.
And it was just Steve and I was going out and doing 10 or 15, and he'd come out and do hour and 15, and we had to cover 90 minutes, and he put them in a nice place. He put them right in what we call the John Wilkes booth at the Comedy Works. It's
right next to the stage.
Right next to the stage. Yeah. Best seats in the house. Because you just can see the whole act. You're feet away from the performer. And the one, both of them were weightlifters, and they worked out all the time, and these, you know, beautiful women. And so I thought, well, you know, Steve's married, you know, at the time. Yeah. And so I thought, you know, well, he could be like the shark, and I could be like the little pilot fish, and, you know,
swim around and pick up the scraps.
The little morsels might fall in my mouth, one of these morsels. So I'm talking to these girls, you know, and they're being real polite, but they're, you know, I'm saying funnier and funnier stuff. I'm giving them my best stuff, and I kind of had some Old Spice on, and, you know, a nice shirt, and, you know, and
Old Spice, yeah. Not even the high karate.
Yeah, you know, and so I can't figure out what's going on. And you're on stage, you know, the whole time, and I'm kind of talking, but you're kind of looking over, and then you said,
Kevin, you tried to pick up a lesbian.
And they were a couple, you know. And
yeah, they were a couple. They were together.
I'm so stupid, you know, like, well, what do you like to do, you know?
Hey, Kevin, you tried to pick up a lesbian.
You guys, folks, the MCs, you know.
So, oh, one of the greatest ever.
Yeah. So we got it passed. Yeah. Some history, I guess.
Yeah. So people can find you. Do you have a Facebook finally? You've come into the...
Well, the Facebook is interesting to me. I didn't even know what it was, you know. And then Mike Rafter, you know, from the comedy book said, you know, you should do this. And
you got to come into the new age.
Try that.
Do you have a Twitter account?
No, I don't know how to do
You're
that.
Not doing Twitter yet?
No. But it changes all the time. You know, like, you got to get a MySpace, you know, and then you got to do this. And then the next thing is gone, you know.
Yeah.
And then you go, you got to do this, and you're not Twitter. And then, you know, I mean, it's so instant, you know. And then the other thing is, I mean, people put on everything they've done that day. I mean, who cares?
You
know,
I took a poop. Here's a picture of my...
The picture of the food. Can you explain that to me?
That's the foodies. That's the people that are really into food and sharing the food. And here, I discovered this. You might want to try this restaurant.
It's a goddamn burrito. You know, I don't want... You know, show me cats playing the violin or some goddamn thing, you know. And there's too much stuff about cats on there.
There's too much stuff about cats.
Oh, man. It's just like... Oh, you know, that's being a veterinarian, it's hard. You go anywhere for dinner and they're going to say, can you see the pictures of my cats? And go, well, please, can I see them?
I think what's odd really is that there's two cats in this basement right now, and they have refused to come out and see you. Are you giving off a vet vibe? Like, that guy will cut your balls off.
Yeah.
Don't go out there. Yeah. He'll stick something up your butt.
No, they're here someplace.
Yeah, they hide in the boxes and look around.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
Oh, man. Thank you. I appreciate you.
I don't know if I think I let you down.
Not at all.
I'm going to think of stories that we should have said, you know.
Oh, the biscuit stories are good. The Rolling Stone stories are always great. See, I wanted to get on here and have you tell more stories than doing, well, Dr. Kevin, why is holly a bad thing to eat at Christmas time?
I wondered. All I did this morning was practice all this stuff about the marijuana and pets. So you have to have me on again.
You want to do like? Well, let's talk about that before you go. There's still time.
Okay.
Because I remember you saying you wanted to mention that because Colorado had gotten we've gotten so pot legal now and pot is everywhere. And you're saying that you see several pets a day at the clinic.
Well, you know, we saw two on Thursday. You know, the dogs unfortunately get into the edibles. You know, and a person to get
like high. The one. Barking behind you.
Yeah. They've been barking during the thing. But that makes it real.
Yeah.
That makes it real. At first I heard that scratching. I thought, I'm doing that with my microphone somehow.
Yeah, it's the dog scratching at the door trying to get to you.
Get in here.
I love him. He touches me funny.
What we're seeing, unfortunately, is, you know, a person to get high will eat, you know, half a brownie. And the dog will get on the countertop and eat the whole tray. So, you know... a person weighs 150, 180 pounds, and, you know, and you know, dog weighs maybe 25. He's a Jack Russell Terrier. And so the half-life is different, you know, that dogs have trouble with canine liver breaking down THC. So half-life for a person, 24, 26 hours, you know.
Yeah.
For a dog, 72, 96 hours. So
are they high that entire time, or are they knocked out?
No, a lot of times they're high, and they're stumbling, and dilated pupils, and, you know, they're bewildered. They don't know what's happening, so it's kind of pitiful. You kind of feel bad, you know. What
would a dog actually... Is there any scientific... Would a dog actually trip in some way? Would it have visions? Would it...
Certainly. They hallucinate. Their coordination is off, you know, just like a person. So, you know, I think that the problem with edibles is, you know, they're way too available. And you know, the pot now, it's not like in the 60s when I was, you know, in school. It's you know, not the old Illini weed and ayahuana and some kind of swag that was being, you know, raised behind the Kmart and Thornton, you know.
Right. It's not some pot that somebody grew in the backyard and mixed with some tobacco and sold it to you.
Yeah, this is genetically engineered stuff that is you know, strong. You know, the Rocky Mountain Poison Center, that, you know, they do testing of the joints, and for a long time, you know, each joint, about 3% THC. Now, you know, characteristically, you know, seeing 12, 14, even, you know, closer to 20%. So the stuff is strong. If you go, you know, out and get a beer tonight, it's 6%. It's standardized, you know, 6% alcohol, you know, not, you know, swag weed. Because the packaging is what's wrong. Because it says, well, you know, this is 32 milligrams of marijuana. Mm-hmm. Well, is it? Ayahuana, or is it really good Jamaican sensimilla?
Right.
You know, and so, So you don't know what you're getting, and so there's no standardization. And the other thing is, they're so ridiculous. You know, this brownie that this woman brought in, it said, eat 1/60th of this. Well,
How much is 1/60th?
You know, we're Irish. If we see a brownie, I'm going to eat the whole damn thing. I'm not going to eat 1/60th, you know. And
save the rest for later.
Yeah, yeah. So it's really powerful. So I think they got a grip on standardization, on packaging, labeling, on you know, tamper proof. You know, I mean, the same thing is being seen, you know, at the Denver General and Children's Hospital with children walking by a countertop, and there's suckers and
gummy bears.
Like, oh man, this stuff comes in. You know, I asked the kid, next to the cigar place where I go, I said, "Hey man, show me how you make this stuff." And they throw butter into a frying pan, and then they start to fry, and then they throw the marijuana in,
mm-hmm.
and then they throw in more butter and more marijuana, and the THC leaches into the butter. It's bound by fat, and so you can achieve higher concentrations in the butter than you can in just the marijuana. And then you strain the butter, get rid of all the leaves and seeds and crunchies, so you're not eating it like the old days when you eat marijuana.
So it's just THC butter, basically.
Yeah, and it's too strong. And so that's the problem I see. You know, we published a paper from our emergency room and just talked about the problem and what we're seeing and just how strong the stuff is. And, you know, I think there needs to be some a little bit better standardization.
So will... Is that something that the vet clinic will work on? Like you guys trying to, except you posted a paper, y'all trying to go to the government and say this needs to be controlled for the animals? Or
well, yeah, I mean, there's so much happening. You know, I mean, it's such a. I think that they let the cow out of the barn a little, you know, and now it's out. I mean, so now you got it. And I think that most states, I think eventually it'll be everywhere. You know, maybe not the South, you know, but. You know, I think you're going to see it in other states. It's on the ballot this time.
Yeah.
You know, and right now, Washington State. You know, yeah. Us in Washington and you know California for medical marijuana. But a lot of claims are being made about marijuana that really we don't know yet. So I would encourage clinical trials. You know, people are saying, oh, it's good for epilepsy. It's good for this. It's good for arthritis. It's good for chronic pain. It's good for. Well, you know, that may be, but. You know, when the FDA gets a bad rap, but they do protect us from charlatanism, from things that don't work. If I prescribe a drug to your dog, it has to be two things. It has to be safe, and it has to be effective. You know, it has to do what I tell you it does.
Yeah.
And not something to just go, here, take these, you know, and call me tomorrow. And you know, it doesn't work. So I think we have to be, you know, truthful and you know, look at it, you know, but a lot of claims are being made. Right now, there's only four things that physicians can prescribe marijuana for. They can give it for glaucoma, lower the intraocular pressure of your eye. They can give it for appetite stimulation in AIDS patients. And they can give it to stop vomiting and nausea in cancer patients on chemo. And then you can give it for some of the side effects of multiple sclerosis. But other than that, a lot of the claims that are being made, you know, you see these poor people with epileptic children and, you know, they'd do anything, you know. I think if it really did work for all these things, we would have known before now.
Yeah, but it's kind of, would it be sort of the same way of them thinking it works much the way of a placebo would? Like, you know, yes, it is sort of working for because you want it to work, or do you think they're actually finding some things that it's working for?
Well, with you know, poor sick people with the placebo effect, you know, I mean, they want it to work, you know, they don't want to be sick, you know, but we have to be so careful. In the 70s, working on my PhD, we worked with tumor cells and estrogen receptors on mammary tumor cells to see if we could shut down the estrogen, shut down the tumor cell. There was a drug called Laetrile that the FDA wouldn't allow, and they said it worked really well against tumors, but there hadn't been a lot of work done, and we were working on these tumor cells with Laetrile, and they did better with the Laetrile.
So I remember that. It was made out of a... Isn't that from
apricot seeds,
yeah.
And so they're saying, oh, you know, the FDA doesn't want to put this out because it would shut down all the industry for the breast cancer surgeons and all the money that's going for chemo. And they don't want that. I mean, Jesus, you don't want people with cancer. So my mother got a tumor, a breast tumor, and I was going that spring break with my roommate and my girlfriend to Mexico for spring break. And we were driving down, and I was sleeping in the passenger seat, and my buddy was asleep in the back, and the girl was driving. And she goes, Kev, wake up. I'm hallucinating. I just thought your mother went by in a car. And I was like, what? No, pull over. You know, I'll drive. And so I started driving, and we came up to this car, and I thought, it does look like my mother's car. I got up. There was my mother and her sister. And they both had mammary tumors. And they were driving to Nogales, Mexico.
Oh, because they did the Laetril.
Because they were selling the Laetril, and I followed them. They didn't know it. And they got into a line with about 150 other American women with breast tumors. And, you know, they were hoping against hope that... But, you know, I mean, it didn't work. You know, so here's people that are victimized by cancer.
Right.
But now they're being victimized by a drug that doesn't work. Right. So they got two, you know, let's help people. So, you know, I think not all the votes are in about marijuana. I think we need to really know these things, you know, before all these claims are being made. And we need to standardize the packaging and make sure that, you know, I mean, geez, eat 1/60th of this thing? I mean, come on, who's going to do that? You know, and the thing about it, you know, the kid eats 1/60th and he doesn't feel anything. Because it takes an hour to get a gut line. Oh, right. You know, I need.
And now eats another one.
Eats another one. And now eats another one. And now, you know, he's gobbled it down. And pretty soon, he's got one eye on his shirt, the other eye looking around the room like a chameleon. You know, and he's going, "What is wrong with me?" And
I got to call 911.
Yeah. So I mean, you want people to be safe. You know, yeah. You want people to be safe. But man, thanks a million for having me.
Oh, thanks for doing the show. And if anybody needs Kevin, you could find him at Alameda East.
Yeah, Veterinary Hospital. Yeah. So,
how long have you been at Alameda East?
32 years.
32 years. So, find him at Alameda East. Find him on Facebook. Don't find him on MySpace. You won't find him on Twitter. But you'll probably find him at Comedy Works.
And I'll respond with a smoke signal.
That was the original Twitter.
Well, you can listen for me on the drums, the jungle drums.
Yeah, thanks for doing this, Kev.
No, thanks for having me.
All right.
Thank you.
See you, man. Well, that's it, kids. I hope you enjoyed our show today with Dr. Kevin Fitzgerald. Well, you probably heard the click, 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 click of all the dog's feet walking around upstairs. I hope that didn't annoy you too much and make you want to turn away. If you made it this far, you didn't, and we appreciate it. As always, we have fun doing it. We hope you have fun listening, and we hope you share this with your friends. Please do. It's Remasculate. It's for everybody. You know, we call it Remasculate, but you ladies get to hear all the good stuff, too. So we appreciate it. Till next time, God bless America. Go listen to some Oak Ridge Boys. We bid you adieu.